Well, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And let's start out with the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. They're having a West Coast Roadshow. You heard about it this afternoon. I'm telling you again. Starts September 17th and runs through October 9th. Here in the Central California area, they have three different shows. On October 1st, that's a Friday night, they'll be in Berkeley, California at the David Brower Center, 2150 Alston Way in Berkeley. And that show starts at 7 p.m. Following night, October 2nd, which is a Saturday night, they'll be here in Santa Cruz at the Sub Rosa, 703 Pacific Avenue. And it says on their schedule they're starting at 7 p.m. On Sunday, October 3rd, they're going to be in San Jose from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Center for Training and Careers, 749 Story Road. So you can find out about all of those on their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. But here's the story. Buffalo Field Campaign's co-founder Mike Meese and dedicated volunteer Noah will soon embark on our 2010 West Coast Roadshow, coming to numerous towns and cities in Washington, Oregon, California, and Nevada. Mike and Noah will share stories and video footage from the front lines work with America's Last Wild Buffalo and talk about ways you can join our efforts to help protect them, even from within your own community. Mike has had nearly two decades of experience in the company of wild buffalo, having lived in one of the coldest climates in the lower 48 states to work in their defense. And he's an amazing storyteller, sure to inspire you to join the growing herd of wild buffalo warriors for the duration of the tour. The Buffalo Field Campaign is excited to announce we will be joined by Lakota musician and activist, the talented Good Shield of Seventh Generation Rise, as well as the incredible Phoenix After Buffalo. Help spread the word. If you want to help us with any of these events, please check the roadshow's schedule and contact the point person at that specific venue to see how you can plug in. You can also spread the word in your community by putting up downloadable posters around your town, neighborhood, and emailing your friends, posting to Facebook, or by any other means you can think of to help spread the word to save the herd. And join the Buffalo Field Campaign for their Woodcut Weekend, September 6th through 12th. That's before the roadshow. They'll be hosting their annual Woodcut Week from the 6th through the 12th of September. They need your help to gather, haul, cut, stack firewood that will keep our volunteers warm all winter. Please make plans to join us for the week of good hard work, tasty meals, friendship, and nights around the Buffalo Field Campaign campfire. For more information on these and other volunteer opportunities, contact Mike Meese at Meese, M-E-A-S-E, at wildrockies.org. You can find out more about the Buffalo Field Campaign at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And they have pages and pages of stuff they need. And one of the things they need is money. You can send that to the Buffalo Field Campaign at P.O. Box 957 and send it to West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you're going to be a volunteer, fill out their application on the website. And certainly before you go, give them a call at 406-646-0070. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a huge Caltrans project is threatening the Smith River and old-growth redwoods, in this story by Amber Jamison. Similar to the Richardson Grove Highway Widening Project, Caltrans has submitted a proposal for highway expansion along Highway 199 and 197 through the old-growth redwoods adjacent to the Middle Fork of the Smith River. This project is more severe than Richardson Grove in that it includes seven locations along the Smith River, which has a national designation as a wild and scenic river. Some of the proposed alternatives include the removal of several large old-growth trees, replacement of several bridges and culverts, including the removal of a historic bridge, and a 400-foot-long retaining wall along the scenic highway. While the comment period for the draft plan has passed, send your comments to Caltrans anyway. For more information, visit the EPIC website, www.epic.org. That's the Environmental Protection Information Center. And they're located up in, I believe it's Eureka these days. And wild steelhead are to regain their endangered species status, so says the court, in this story by Carol J. Williams of the Los Angeles Times. Federal appeals panel has rebuffed Central Valley Irrigators' efforts to relax U.S. protections on the Pacific salmon. A federal appeals court has ruled that wild steelhead remain an endangered species and rebuffed Central Valley Irrigators' efforts to relax federal protections for Pacific salmon. Six irrigation districts had challenged the National Marine Fisheries Service decision to list the ocean-going steelhead separately from the more plentiful freshwater rainbow trout on the grounds that the two fish interbreed and that steelhead are therefore protected from extinction. Both types of Pacific salmonids are born in freshwater, but steelhead migrate to the ocean, whereas rainbow trout remain in rivers and lakes. Wild steelhead once returned to the Sacramento and San Joaquin River systems by the millions each year, but their population has dwindled by 95% because of excessive water use by irrigation districts, pollution, dam construction, and urban sprawl. Earth Justice Attorney Steve Mashuda argued on behalf of a group of conservationists and fishing enthusiasts. The three-judge panel of the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed that steelhead were indeed in need of separate classification despite interbreeding of the two salmon species. The two species grow to different sizes and have different predators and prey, the court noted, adding that abundant steelhead can regenerate dwindling rainbow trout stocks, but the reverse does not seem to be the case. The ruling was hailed by the environmental and fishing groups who intervened to defend the government agency against the irrigators' lawsuit. Anyone who's ever been lucky enough to see or catch a steelhead in the wild knows they're a special fish, said Mark Rockwell of the Northern California Council of the Federation of Fly Fishers. And will the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife make it easier to kill wolves? Not if you have a say about it. Now is an important time for Oregon wolves. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is currently reviewing a five-year-old wolf conservation and management plan. Agency officials are getting intense pressure from those who would like to see nothing more than an extermination of any wolf in Oregon once again. Will we allow anti-wolf interests to succeed and make it easier to kill wolves? The answer, nope, not without your help. But we can speak out for Oregon's fragile wolf population. Attend a vitally important public meeting at the Washington County Fair Complex, the Cloverleaf Building, at 873 Northeast 34th Avenue in Hillsboro, Oregon, next Thursday, September 2nd at 8 p.m. Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commissioners are meeting to hear recommendations from agency staff on changes to the wolf plan. They will also be taking public comment. Discussion of the wolf plan will take place in the second half of the second hang, but it is advisable to get there at 8 a.m. to sign up for your chance to testify. Here's some ideas for what you could say. Don't make it easier for private citizens or government hunters to kill wolves as they struggle to recover in Oregon. Use the best available science to determine recovery goals and consider enhancing target population numbers. Always prioritize non-lethal tools when working to avoid livestock conflicts. Do not extend Caught in the Act kill permit authorization to public lands, and ensure that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is the primary decision-making agency in wolf management decisions, considering Wildlife Service's proven track record as an unreliable wolf management agency. Push for full funding of the plan to allow managers the resources needed to educate the public and implement non-lethal strategies for avoiding wolf-livestock conflicts. And if you'd like to send comments to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, their address, ODFW, 3406 Cherry Avenue Northeast, Salem, Oregon, 97303. Once again, that address, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, 3406 Cherry Avenue Northeast, Salem, Oregon, 97303. Their email address, odfw.commission@coho2.dfw.state.or.us. And that email address again, odfw.commission@coho2.dfw.state.or.us. And for more information, contact OregonWild.org. That's www.OregonWild.org. And once again, that meeting, next Thursday evening, September 2nd at 8 p.m., the address, the Washington County Fair Complex, Cloverleaf Building, 873 Northeast 34th Avenue, Hillsboro, Oregon. And get there at 8 a.m. to sign up. And in a victory, the Vendetta mine plan on Sacred Tribal Mountain is halted by the Indian government. And this is not in the United States. This is in the subcontinent of India. Vedanta's controversial bauxite mine on the Dongria Khan's tribal land has been stopped after 4 years of protest by local people supporting the Survival International and a wide range of affinity campaigns, including most recently by Ecological Internet's Earth Action Network. Controversial plans to develop the bauxite mine on sacred tribal land in India have been canceled by India's Environmental Ministry. The Dongria Khans, an indigenous tribe who have lived since time immemorial around the mountain Niyamgiri in the Indian state of Orissa, demands have been met and the area will remain wild, lush, and sacred. Multinational company Vedanta, existing aluminum refinery in the area, had polluted local rivers, damaged crops, and disrupted the lives of the local tribe, and will now not be able to expand by sixfold. This is a Dongria Khan victory, first and foremost. It's great to have your tribal homeland protected. The project has been delayed by 4 years because of Dongria Khan's intense opposition locally, including the brandishing of bows and arrows, as well as from environmental and tribal rights groups. Globally, a loosely coordinated campaign sought to persuade multinational Vedanta's shareholders and financiers to distance themselves from the company. This is their magnificent victory as well for Survival International and Amnesty International, various celebrity activists such as Bianca Jagger and Michael Palin, and not related to what's her name, and numerous other loosely affiliated campaigns, including most recently from the Ecological Internet working with the Rainforest Information Center. The project had been thrown into doubt last week when a government inquiry said that mining would destroy the way of life of the area's endangered and primitive people. The four-person committee also accused a local subsidiary of Vedanta of violating forest conservation and environment protection regulations. Because Niyamgiri Mountain is an important spiritual place, it had not thus far suffered from deforestation and degradation experienced by similar areas in India, but contains an elephant reserve with sambar, leopard, tiger, barking deer, various species of birds, and other endangered species of wildlife. With the announcement, the area is free for now from the planned Vedanta bauxite mine. Jairam Ramesh, India's Minister of the Environment and Forest, said that the government will issue what is termed a show cause notice and take action against Vedanta. The news sent Vedanta's shares down almost 6%, wiping out £300 million off the value of the business. There are very serious violations of the Environment Act and Forest Rights Act, Ramesh told Bloomberg News. There is no emotion, no politics, no prejudice in the decision is purely based on a legal approach. Vedanta, which can appeal against the decision, had wanted to expand its existing refinery in the area, generating a six-fold increase in capacity. Survival campaigner Dr. Joe Woodman said this is a victory nobody would have believed possible. The Dongria's campaign became a litmus test of whether a small, marginalized tribe could stand up to a massive multinational company with an army of lobbyists and PR firms in the ear of the government. Incredibly, the Dongria's courage and tenacity, affiliated with the support of many people in India and survival supporters around the world, have triumphed. This is the second time Ecological Internet's Earth Action Network has recently achieved major conservation successes in India. Last year, also working with John Seed and the Rainforest Information Center, Ecological Internet was able to single-handedly achieve major Asian elephant migration corridor protections. And if you want more information, go to the website www.ecoearth.info. That's ecoearth.info. And I really can't stand Dr. Glenn Berry's ego sometimes, but apparently it's working. So anyway, we're here's another one from the Ecological Internet, just so you can get these two stories back to back. Please encourage the Rainforest Action Network, the new leader of the Rainforest Action Network, to end primary forest logging. Rainforest Action Network has a much-needed new executive director, Rebecca Tarbottom, For almost 2 years, Ecological Internet has worked to get the once luminary Old Growth Protection Organization to stop supporting Forest Stewardship Council's certification for industrial first-time logging of 500-year-old trees in millions-of-year-old primary forests as well-managed, while implying sustainability for throwaway consumer products like toilet paper and lawn furniture. Rand co-founded the Forest Stewardship Campaign, or a council, and is a longtime staunch member. Getting major forest protection organizations like RAN and Greenpeace to resign from the FSC is a necessary first step before together we can campaign to end primary forest logging as a keystone response to global ecological sustainability. Using only publicly available information, the Ecological Internet estimates some 120 million hectares of primary forest, an area two times the size of Texas and about 60% of Forest Stewardship Council's timber, have been logged for the first time or are threatened by first-time industrial logging with FSC certification and RAND support. To date, RAND has not been very responsive, and we ask that you contact Ms. Tarbottom to congratulate her on the new position and respectfully ask that RAND re-examine their support of the Forest Stewardship Council and commit to working to end primary forest logging. You may want to take note that ecological science indicates that the Earth has lost more intact terrestrial ecosystems, including primary forests, than are necessary to maintain a workable biosphere in the long term. And the protection and restoration of old forests is a keystone response to both climate and biodiversity crises. In November of 2008, the Rainforest Action Network committed to reviewing their Forest Stewardship Council membership, a promise that has never been kept. Ecological Internet is willing to debate on the important forest policy of whether primary forest must end at any time, any place, but have thus far been stonewalled. And just recently, the Swedish Society for the Conservation of Nature, Sweden's largest environmental group, resigned from the Forest Stewardship Council over similar concerns. You may also choose to like Ecological Internet's earlier posting as a sign of support. Just a simple posting like congrats, please leave FSC, or please get ran out of primary forest logging is fine. This method of campaigning has been used by Greenpeace against Nestle, and it proved very effective. This is very important for Earth's old forest and sustainability, so please do it now. This is written by Dr. Glenn Berry of the Ecological Internet, and you can get more information at www.rainforestportal.org. And there are major problems with the Forest Stewardship Council selling out primary forests. And a U.S. judge has banned the planting of genetically engineered beets in this story by Dan Levine, with writing by Dan Whitcomb. Additional reporting by Steve Gorman of in Los Angeles and Tom Dockett in Washington, with editing by Peter Cooney. And we get this courtesy of Thomson Reuters Environmental News Service. A federal judge has banned the planting of genetically modified sugar beets engineered by Monsanto Company in a ruling that marks a major setback for the biotech giant. U.S. District Judge Jeffrey White ruled in 2009 that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had approved Monsanto's genetically modified sugar beets without adequate environmental study. Sugar beets account for over half of the nation's sugar supply, but conventional sugar beet seeds remain widely available. And environmentalists filing suit said the judge's decision should not significantly affect sugar production. White's decision to impose the ban did not apply to crops already planted or harvested. It stems from a lawsuit brought by environmentalists over Monsanto sugar beets engineered to be resistant to the weed killer Roundup, also known as glyphosate. Roundup is also manufactured by Monsanto and was sold to farmers together with the genetically altered sugar beet seeds. It's a victory for farmers, for the environment, and for the public, said George Kimbrell, a senior staff attorney for the Center for Food Safety plaintiffs in the case. Environmentalists have argued that the Roundup-ready crops have increased the use of herbicides and herbicide-resistant weeds. Monsanto has claimed in court papers that revoking the government's approval of its genetically modified seed could cost the company and its consumers, that's customers, $2 billion this year and next. Agriculture Department spokesperson Kayla Weaver said the USDA was reviewing the judge's order to determine appropriate next steps. A Monsanto representative referred reporters to Dwayne Grant, an Idaho sugar beet farmer and chairman of the Snake River Sugar Cooperative. Before planting next spring's 2011 crop, we are going to have to understand all of the implications of the judge's ruling and what might be open to us, Grant said. He said that since White's decision did not apply to sugar beets already planted or harvested, really, there is no immediate impact on sugar availability or cost to the consumer. Sugar beets make up a little over half of the U.S. sugar crop, and 95% of sugar beets come from Roundup Ready seed, Grant said. The Center for Food Safety has countered that farmers can easily go back to using conventional sugar beet seeds, which were widely used as recently as 2 years ago. Most U.S. sugar beets are planted in March, April, and May, he said. The government has valued the sugar beet crop, which is largely grown in 11 states, the bulk of them in the Midwest, at $1.335 billion in the year 2007 and 8. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a separate federal judge's ruling revoking the USDA's approval of Monsanto's genetically modified alfalfa until a full environmental review was completed on that crop. And an alpine glacier protection bill could shut down some mines. In this story by Luis Andres Henao, editing by Hillary Burke and David Gregorio of Thomson Reuters Environmental News Service. An Argentine bill to protect glaciers by banning mining in ice zones could hinder a few new multi-billion dollar gold mines, shutter some projects, and slow investment, although some mining provinces seeking to circumvent the measure are passing their own laws. The Senate is weighing the politically popular bill, backed by the opposition after the lower house of Congress passed it last week. Proponents say it is crucial to ensuring Argentina's water supplies into the future. President Cristina Fernandez has said she would sign the bill, even though she vetoed a similar bill 2 years ago, citing economic grounds. The proposed law could make it more expensive or even impossible for Barrick Gold Corporation to develop Pascua Lama, one of the world's last known mega gold finds being built along the mountainous Argentina-Chile border. The law's passage could have a deep impact on Pascua Lama and could limit the development of the other mining projects, many of them high in the Andes, by banning them outright, said Damian Altgelt, general manager of CAEM Mining Chamber. Barrick said it has already committed over 25% of the capital for Pascua Lama, with the project's pre-production capital budget estimated at $2.8 to $3 billion. The bill, which also bans oil drilling on the country's glaciers, is aimed at safeguarding Argentina's freshwater reserves. It sets the standard for protecting glaciers and surrounding areas and creates penalties for companies that pollute or damage ice fields. Up to now, mining projects just had to prove they would not harm the environment, Altgelt said. Now, if the project is located on a glacier or in this ambiguous concept of being near one, it's simply banned. Mining-friendly provincial governments are already passing laws that are more flexible than the national bill, arguing they have the constitutional right to manage their natural resources. Three provinces, La Rioja, Jujuy, and San Juan, site of Barrick's Veladero and Pascua Lama mines, have passed their own laws. They say mining projects in glacial areas should be banned only if an environmental assessment commissioned by the local government shows they have an adverse effect. Four other provinces have agreed to take similar action. Provincial laws are trying to block this law, but environmental bills like the one we're trying to pass are national and thus set the standard, said Miguel Bonasso, National Glacier Protection Bill's sponsor in the lower house. A long court battle could result if the laws continue on a collision course, constitutional expert Gregorio Bademi said, adding that ultimately Congress trumps the provinces in regulating mining activity. If the law is passed, Barrick and other miners will not be able to continue their projects, he said, but Barrick could demand hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation from the Argentine government because these mining activities were not banned when they made these investments. He said Barrick, the world's largest gold miner, could also argue the law does not apply to areas where it operates. In San Juan Province, Barrick's Veladero mine produced 611,000 ounces of gold last year. The company is also developing Pascua Lama there, which straddles the Chilean border at some 5,000 meters or 16,440 feet above sea level. Pascua Lama has proven in probable reserves of 17.8 million ounces of gold. The average annual output is expected to be between 750 and 800,000 ounces of gold in the first 5 years of operation. Environmentalists say studies and satellite images show Pascua Lama is located in a glacial area. Barrick disputes this, saying the ore body it was authorized to mine in Pascua Lama and its Veladero mine are not under ice fields or glaciers, so would not be restricted by the new law. Barrick operations should not affect any glacier, company spokesperson Rodrigo Jimenez said. Our project will not affect the community's water source or the environment. We are extremely confident that the Argentine federal and provincial legislative framework will continue to support and encourage responsible mineral development, Jimenez said. However, the lawmaker Bonasso warned Veladero could be closed down if the glacier bill passed. If the law were enacted today, Barrick would be infringing it because Veladero is located in a periglacial area, Bonasso said. Barrick could be asked to move its development or even cease operations. When President Fernandez vetoed a previous glacier protection law in 2008, she said it jeopardized economic development in mineral-rich provinces like San Juan. Environmentalists and political opponents accused her of being in cahoots with big mining companies, and she appears eager to shed that image ahead of an October 2011 election. Hernandez's husband and predecessor, former President Nestor Kirchner, is expected to run for president next year, and he would need the support of progressive middle-class voters. The bill will most likely pass in the Senate to become law, said Rosendo Fraga, a political analyst. The president has decided not to veto it because he knows the high political cost it would entail. Fraga said lawmakers could still delay the bill's passage into the Senate and even send it back to the lower house for changes to keep it in economic limbo while provincial governments advance their own laws. The law's passage would be crucial to protecting glaciers as the country's main source of fresh water, according to Ricardo Villalba, director of the IANIGLA, Government Institute for Snow and Glacial Research. Glaciers circulate water in the Andes when it doesn't snow or rain. That's why they're key, Villalba said. The spirit of the law is to preserve this resource that has a vital significance in the Andes. I hope it passes. And let's move to biological diversity news. A rare invertebrate habitat is going to be protected from big oil. In response to a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and the Wild Earth Guardians, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed a new critical habitat protection for three endangered snails and a freshwater shrimp in New Mexico's Bitter Lake National Wildlife Refuge and in western Texas. A previous suit by the center prompted the service to protect 397 acres for the Pecos Acimineia snail in 2002, but the agency failed to include any sites within the refuge or to protect a single acre for three other imperiled aquatic invertebrates within the area, the Roswell spring snail, Custer's spring snail, and Knowles amphipod. The current proposal would protect 118 acres for all four species, which are largely jeopardized. 118 acres for all four species, which are largely jeopardized by oil and gas drilling in and near the refuge that threatens to contaminate the clean water they depend on. In 1994, Yates Petroleum spilled brine into the refuge that contained a chlorine content 20 times state standards, a deadly addition to the sensitive creature's watery habitat. If the habitat proposal is finalized, it will also entail protections across a 12,585-acre watershed just upstream of the protected Bitter Lake Refuge area. The newly proposed critical habitat areas include all wetlands where these rare animals are still found, said Michael Robinson of the center. Critical habitat will help keep these waters clean and these unique animals alive. And nine young condors will soon fly free, but they're in need of a lead-free home. In case you don't know it, California condors don't only come from California. In fact, the Oregon Zoo is lending a big hand to boosting the endangered birds' wild populations, whose current range includes California, Arizona, and Utah. Thanks to the zoo's condor captive breeding program, it's now harboring three new condor chicks who just hatched this spring as they build strength before they fledge into the pens their parents occupy. Meanwhile, six juvenile condors hatched at the zoo are on their way to pre-release pens in California and Arizona. Well, they'll be under the watch of a mentor bird and kept on a pretty tight leash while they gain the skills needed for survival in the wild. Unfortunately, one of the biggest threats to condor survival in the wild, lead poisoning, can't be countered with any amount of preparation by parents or mentor birds. Condors frequently scavenge carcasses shot with lead bullets, or shot and consume lead fragments, which cause the birds often to get sick and die, and much of the wild population suffers from chronic sublethal effects of lead poisoning. Three condors in Arizona have recently died from lead poisoning, and a chick in California last month underwent intensive care because of lead poisoning. For the sake of the whole California condor species, plus countless other creatures who are exposed to lead from bullets, including us, the Center for Biological Diversity is leading a campaign to require non-lead bullets for hunting nationwide. We've already won the requirement in the condor's California range, and they're hoping to get it extended into Arizona and New Mexico. And Utah, and other places. The feds are sued over ocean noise harming marine animals in the Gulf. Battling yet another threat inflicted on Gulf of Mexico marine life by the oil and gas industry, the Center for Biological Diversity and allies have sued the feds over the use of painfully noisy seismic surveys. The powerful surveys approved by the former Minerals Management Service without proper environmental analysis can disrupt the feeding, breeding, and basic communication of whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals. Still, dozens of harmful seismic surveys are carried out each year throughout the Gulf's outer continental shelf, surveys using some of the loudest underwater sounds ever generated by humans to explore for oil and gas beneath the ocean floors. Underwater noise can lead to permanent or temporary hearing loss, internal hemorrhaging, stranding, and death in marine mammals. Throughout the year, whales are disturbed and harmed by blasts nearly as loud as explosives from constant seismic surveys exploring for oil in the Gulf, said Center Oceans Director Miyoko Sakashita. As with drilling, the federal government rubber stamps permits for these disruptive surveys and turns a blind eye to the impacts on whales and other wildlife. And if you'd like more information on that, you can go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And we thank the Center for Biological Diversity for their continuing news updates. And we never get through all of them. They have quite an extensive PR campaign. And we thank them for that. Always great news. And that's it for the Earth First update for this week. If you'd like to hear a podcast or download a previous Earth First update, here's where you go, www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we want to thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and archiving those shows for our listeners. And the Earth First Update will be back next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock. We want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We'll see you back here next Thursday at 9 o'clock.